Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The car that burst into a fireball in front of the famous painting of Chairman Mao Zedong in Beijing on Monday was a carefully planned terrorist attack. That's according to Chinese police. Officials are now saying that the petrol was deliberately ignited inside the car, killing the driver and two passengers. For more, we have this story from Stephen McDonald in Beijing.
Initially, the Chinese press called this a car crash. Now, police here say it was a carefully planned, organized, and premeditated violent terrorist attack. Chinese officials have started providing details of what they're suggesting was a suicide mission. A man named Usman Hassan somehow broke through barriers, we're told. He ploughed his car into the crowd, killing two bystanders and injuring many more. Then it hit a decorative bridge in front of the Tiananmen Gate. Fuel was deliberately ignited, incinerating the driver and two passengers, his wife and his mother. Police say they've found knives and jihadist banners in the wreckage of the vehicle. Five others have also been detained for allegedly helping. According to official statements, they were rounded up with help from the authorities in the far western province of Xinjiang. This, along with the names released of those apparently involved and the car's Xinjiang number plates, would seem to suggest that those being held are ethnic Uyghurs from this vast Muslim province. Many in this Turkic-speaking area are seeking independence from China, and some are prepared to use violence to achieve it. But up until now, the at times bloody struggle has been played out within Xinjiang. So if the police are right about this incident, it would be a clear change of tactics, bringing the conflict to the heart of Chinese power, in the city's most iconic and sensitive location. And all this less than 2 weeks before a crucial meeting of the Communist Party, which is expected to consider major economic reforms here. What's likely to come next is a significant crackdown in Xinjiang province. Though the area around Tiananmen Square is already crawling with security, the Chinese government won't want this week's car immolation to inspire others to copy the strategy.
That was China correspondent Stephen McDonald reporting from Beijing. A legislative push by Japan's government to clamp down on intelligence leaks is set to pass the country's parliament, sparking major concerns about freedom of information. Shinzo Abe's Liberal Democratic Party has given cabinet approval for the state secret bill, which will give government departments free rein to classify information if they deem it sensitive. Japan's government says the move is vital for shoring up its military alliance with the United States. But journalists and legal experts warn the legislation will have a chilling effect on free speech. Bill Bertels has more.
Having been signed off on by Japan's cabinet on Friday last week, the state secrets bill is all but certain to pass the Diet, meaning the most restrictive information regulation since World War II will soon become law. Japan has long been regarded as a country where intelligence secrets leak easily. And when speaking on Friday, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said the situation is getting worse.
The fact of the matter is that leaks are on the increase. A system that can prevent intelligence leaks relating to Japan's security is essential, especially in relation to top secret information.
The legislation will give senior officials in government departments the power to classify information for at least 5 years. Public servants found to be passing on classified information will be liable for 10 years in jail. Jeffrey Kingston, the Director of Asian Studies at Temple University in Japan, says the Abe government sees the secrecy provisions as vital for Japan's alliance with the US.
Well, they're justifying it as a prerequisite to establishing a National Security Council. And Abe has long desired to do this. He tried to establish one back when he was premier in 2007. And now he wants to get that going. And he says, well, it's vital that we get access to U.S. intelligence, and Washington's not going to share their secrets with us if they don't believe that we can keep a secret.
He says, as the WikiLeaks disclosures and the Edward Snowden case shows, Japan isn't the only country that has problems keeping secrets. And that's prompted many questions over the need for the new laws.
Well, it's really interesting that the national broadcaster NHK, which is normally reliably pro-government, has had a series of programs in which they've talked about the secrecy legislation in a very critical way, which surprised me. And one of these programs, they invoked, well, this seems to be a dangerous return to the wartime situation. So I think there is widespread concern. NHK does have a huge influence on public attitudes. And a lot of people are wondering, why is it necessary?
Some political experts have speculated that the law could be used to suppress embarrassing information, including problems at the trouble-plagued Fukushima nuclear plant. But Joel Rubin, a Tokyo-based lawyer carrying out postgraduate research on Japanese public law, says the recent nuclear plant problems are not a big factor behind the bill.
If you look at the way that the bill has been drafted, it is specifically related to information that goes to things like defence, espionage, international affairs and so forth. And I think that there would have to be a fairly wide interpretation of the relevant provisions, as badly drafted as they are, to include things like the Fukushima nuclear disaster. But I think the bigger point is that there is no oversight under this law. Once a determination has been made that a document is classified, there's no real opportunity for a third party to test that.
And it's not just public servants who may find themselves in the firing line. Private sector workers, including journalists, face up to 5 years in jail if they're found to have used grossly inappropriate means to obtain and leak state secrets. Concerns from media outlets and other political parties in the Diet have prompted the government to include safeguards, though Joel Rubin says there are serious flaws.
There is a provision now which says that in enforcing the law, the government needs to have regard to freedom of speech and freedom of the press and fundamental human rights. And there is also a provision that says, for example, with respect to setting standards on what will and will not be considered classified information, the government needs to consult with eminent persons in drafting those standards. But I don't think that they are particularly robust safeguards at all.
Staying in Japan, the operator of Japan's crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant will soon begin the most dangerous phase so far of the decommissioning process. In an operation never attempted before, TEPCO will begin removing more than 1,000 used fuel units from the deep pool, which sit high above the ground in a scattered reactor building. The pool contains 10 times more radioactive material than was released in Chernobyl. Mark Willisey reports from Japan.
Its upper stories were ripped apart in a massive explosion just days after the meltdowns, the blast tearing away the roof and walls of the Reactor 4 building, leaving just twisted steel and exposing the reactor's nuclear fuel pool to the elements. Inside that pool, perched five stories above the ground, were 1,331 used nuclear fuel assemblies. Experts around the world have been warning for 2.5 years that the fuel pool is in a precarious state, vulnerable to collapsing in another big earthquake.
This has me very scared.
Yale University professor Charles Perrow wrote about the number 4 fuel pool this year in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. In an interview with the ABC, he said that one pool contains 10 times the amount of radioactive cesium-137 than Chernobyl, warning that one slip-up with the removal of this highly radioactive fuel could trigger a chain reaction.
Tokyo would have to be evacuated because of cesium and other poisons that are there. Will spread very rapidly. Even if the wind is blowing in the other way, it's going to be monumental.
It's taken the operator of the Fukushima plant, TEPCO, more than 2.5 years to clear away debris and get the number 4 reactor building ready for this delicate operation. In an interview with the ABC, TEPCO's Yoshimi Hitasugi insisted the company's engineers are ready. We're going to transfer the fuel into containers while it's underwater, says Mr. Hitasugi. Then we'll use a crane to remove the containers and take them to a new pool, he says. Even Japan's nuclear watchdog is urging TEPCO to exercise the utmost caution, with the chief of the Nuclear Regulation Authority telling the company's president this week to proceed very carefully, warning that if TEPCO hits a problem, the risks will grow. TEPCO's Yoshimi Hitasugi has told the ABC that engineers have reinforced the shattered building, propped up the fuel pool and installed a new crane. He says there's nothing to worry about. We believe it's not dangerous, he says. The reactor building is structurally sound. We don't believe there'll be any accident, he adds. This is by far the most complex and dangerous phase of the Fukushima decommissioning so far, and it's a test of TEPCO's technical prowess ahead of what will be an even more challenging task in the years to come, removing the piles of nuclear fuel at the bottom of reactors 1, 2 and 3.
Indonesia has been described as a shining light in the Asia-Pacific region for its progress towards reducing child mortality. That's the assessment made by the charity Save the Children. In the AIDS Group's latest report, Indonesia ranks at the top of the Asia-Pacific. Its child mortality rate has been reduced by 40% over the last decade. Tom Maddox has more.
The report tracked global efforts to curb child mortality as countries work toward the UN's Millennium Development Goal of a two-thirds reduction by 2015. Indonesia is making the greatest strides in the Asia-Pacific region.
Indonesia is the shining light in our region. It has managed to reduce child mortality by around 40% over the last decade, which is a tremendous result.
Paul Ronalds is the head of Save the Children Australia. He says economic growth and a committed government is driving progress in Indonesia. He's confident it can be sustained, but warns more work needs to be done.
What Indonesia has done well and what is behind its improvements is obviously its overall economic growth. It's increased from about 1,180 per person, that's GDP, to about $1,731. So that's a 46% increase in GDP. So that's very powerful. It's had a national plan and that's focused the mind of the national government. That's been terrific. And it's invested in the basic health services and grown the national health budget, which has also helped to do that. But if we're going to continue to see further reductions in child mortality in Indonesia, there does need to be a continued focus in rural areas. There needs to be a continued focus in urban slum areas, which are quite significant in the context of Indonesia. And there needs to be continued and perhaps increased focus on girls and ensuring that girls get at least equal access to basic health services that boys are currently enjoying.
Economic growth in India and China is also helping to reduce child mortality. Paul Ronalds says China's healthcare plan has also made significant inroads. China has joined a number of countries who have reduced child mortality to below 2%, the threshold for ending preventable child deaths. Paul Ronalds says China and Indonesia's success can be transferred to parts of the Pacific.
A national plan will look different in Papua New Guinea than what it does in Indonesia. Each has its own challenges and political context. But the fact that a national government is focused on achieving significant reductions in child mortality helps to focus the whole political system.
In the Pacific, huge gains have been made in vaccination and antenatal care, water sanitation and nutrition. The highest mortality rate for children under 5 is in Kiribati, with 37%, down from 65% in 1990. Dr. Karen Allen is the UNICEF representative for 14 Pacific Island countries. She says the Pacific has made tremendous progress since 1990, but Dr. Allen says the biggest issue is reaching people in the remote outlying regions of the Pacific.
Realistically, you're not going to set up a full-scale hospital in every one of our 660 islands in these 14 countries that I cover. So what can you do to go after the last hard-to-reach, very disadvantaged groups of people? That's the question we're dealing with now and that the governments in the Pacific are dealing with now.
Despite ongoing issues with remote areas, young children in poor urban centres are also suffering. Leading causes of death include pneumonia, diarrhoea, malaria, and complications with pregnancy and birth. 44% of deaths under 5 occur in the first month. But Dr. Allen says where progress has been made, it's in part thanks to cold chains. The system of transporting refrigerated containers is critical in getting vaccines to both urban and rural districts and areas hardest to reach.
Most of this progress has been due to the installation of huge cold chain rooms in the first instance on the main island, supported by solar-powered refrigerators in the outer islands. And, you know, going after the vaccine-preventable diseases, you know, it, at first it's an easy win in the main population areas, but getting to the outer reaches, these solar chill rooms have made a huge difference. So that's where a lot of progress is being made. And now what the Pacific Islands are trying to do is roll out the next generation of vaccines, which is against pneumonia and rotavirus and hepatitis. And that will also really make a dent in the mortality rate when that happens.
A new mosquito-borne virus has infected tens of thousands of people in Papua New Guinea and much of Asia. The Chikungunya virus is similar to dengue fever and causes painful joint pain, rashes, and fever. And with the outbreak in PNG, scientists say it's only a matter of time before the virus spreads among mosquitoes in northern Australia. Liam Cochran has more from Port Moresby.
A family holiday to Bali turned into a medical nightmare for Christine Mannix, and it all started right beside the resort swimming pool.
I actually felt two bites, and they were really quite vicious bites, and I looked and you could see two punch marks.
The aggressive bites suggest an Asian tiger mosquito was probably the culprit, but the real trouble for Christine Mannix began a day later once she got home to Melbourne.
Woke up with horrendous pain. Walked to the toilet, could barely walk. My hands, my feet, everything ached. The pain was excruciating. I just felt really, really unwell.
And she was unwell. Christine Mannix didn't know it yet, but she'd been infected with the mosquito-borne chikungunya virus. It's rarely fatal, but chikungunya causes severe joint pain, rashes and fever.
Debilitating, absolutely overwhelming, excruciating, a deep bone pain.
Mrs. Mannix couldn't work and lost the dexterity in her hands to the point where she couldn't turn a doorknob. The chikungunya virus was first recognised in Tanzania in 1952 and gets its unusual name from a local word meaning that which is bent upwards, a reference to being doubled over in pain. Since emerging, chikungunya has spread to parts of Africa and Asia. In June last year, the virus was detected for the first time in northwest Papua New Guinea. Boris Pavlin is an epidemiologist with the World Health Organization and says the small seaside town of Vanimo alone reported 1,600 cases.
We started to see similarly explosive outbreaks in other populations, other centers such as in Rabaul, hundreds of cases reported in November of last year, eventually coming to Port Moresby in April of this year. Again, some clinics reporting that their clinics were just full of chikungunya cases.
The virus quickly spread to at least 11 provinces, infecting an estimated tens of thousands of people and putting further strain on PNG's already weak health system. In May this year, chikungunya was confirmed on Manus Island, where more than 1,000 asylum seekers are housed in tents. But the head of the main hospital there says there have been no reports of asylum seekers becoming infected. While the outbreak in PNG has been huge, Boris Pavlin says the true scale of the problem is likely to be even bigger.
For every case that comes to a health centre, there may be 10 more that get treated at home or just simply aren't recorded.
A report released this month by the Australian Department of Health describes chikungunya as a major threat to Australia. One of the authors was David Harley, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the Australian National University.
There has been a lot of chikungunya activity in Papua New Guinea, so depending on travel patterns there, perhaps for work, we may see the virus coming from that country as well. So I think it is very likely that we will see transmission, most particularly in North Queensland, in the future.
So far this year, 112 cases of chikungunya have been detected in Australia from overseas infections. But experts say it's just a matter of time before Australian mosquitoes start spreading the virus. Queensland already has one of the mosquito species known to transmit the virus, Aedes aegypti, and the state's on constant lookout for another carrier, Aedes albopictus, better known as the Asian tiger mosquito. ANU Associate Professor of Epidemiology David Harley says a major outbreak could have an impact on tourism and on Australia's supply of donated blood.
So depending on the strategies that were taken to protect the blood supply, this virus could also reduce the supply of blood and blood products in the same way that dengue virus does.
The recent report in the Communicable Diseases Intelligence Journal recommends the Australian government continue biosecurity measures to control mosquitoes and says more information is needed about chikungunya cases to better understand the risk. Even now, 5 months after first being infected, Christine Mannix still experiences mild symptoms of lethargy and joint pain. There's currently no cure for chikungunya, and Christine Mannix wants her painful experience to be a lesson to other travellers.
Efforts are underway to revive the fortunes of India's only Chinatown. Once a thriving community of some 25,000 with its own schools and social clubs, the population in Calcutta's Chinatown has now dwindled to around 1,500. But local authorities are backing a plan to restore the area and promote tourism there. Murali Krishnan has more.
It's bustling in the congested Tiruti Bazaar at the city's fringe, which is widely known as the original Chinatown. It is one of the few remaining places in India where one can buy authentic Chinese snacks and delicacies like steamed pork buns, dim sum and fish balls. Kolkata's Chinese community has been a key part of the city's cultural and social fabric for more than 200 years. Many came as immigrants to India in the late 18th century, driven by famine in central China. A majority belongs to the Hakka community and found work in the port, set up leather tanneries and opened restaurants. But when hostilities broke out between India and China in 1962, the exodus began. Things got only worse for the community in the late 90s when the Supreme Court moved the leather tanneries out of the city. That left many unemployed and several tanneries were forced to shut down. Eileen Lung is a fourth generation Chinese resident.
A lot of money have been spent to start up a business all over again in the leather complex. Hence, many of them have lost interest. They have lost a lot of money. So they have migrated abroad, like Canada, Australia. The population have declined.
Despite living here for many years, distrust persists. Many Chinese Indians remain wary of any official contact and seek little or no favors from the government to set up their enterprises. Paul Chung, president of the Indian Chinese Association, sums it up well.
If the baby don't cry, you won't get your food. So the Chinese don't cry. We don't hear any Chinese having demonstration. We usually, when there's something, we go to some other political party. They pay lip service. They console you that they do that. When we have our right, we think is violated, we will stand up for it. We will use the same method as the democracy, the process does.
Lang Lee, a youth, believes the Indian government should do much more to reach out to the Chinese community to stop a further exodus.
Because they are all moving on the greener pasture. Reason is that they are not finding. The government doesn't give us anything brighter. Government doesn't give us anything. The government doesn't give us the right to a free space.
But despite the disconnect, gloom could soon lead to hope and cheer for this community. There is now talk of a revival of Chinatown. Earlier this year, following representations by some eminent citizens and the Indian National Trust for Art and Cultural Heritage, a proposal was sent to restore and renovate Chinatown and promote tourism. The local government has also agreed to partner in the project. Dominic Lee, a grocery shop owner, is part of this enterprise.
We are planning to revive old Chinatown so that the present generation and the future generation will stay back. First and foremost thing is we have to create opportunities for the youth. We are in the process of collaborating with a Singapore firm. It's an organization and also Intact also. We have approached the government also. Hopefully, very soon we will have a revived Chinatown, a thriving Chinatown, and the only one in India.
Called the Cha Project or Tea Project, the endeavor is expected to help preserve old Chinatown in Tiruti Bazaar and will also focus on developing the new Chinatown in Tangra. Many within the community are hoping this project takes off.
And finally on the program, after years of war and the murderous Khmer Rouge regime, Cambodia's audiovisual heritage was in danger of being lost. But now there is a concentrated effort underway in Phnom Penh at the Bupana Center to preserve that heritage with the help of French aid money and a group of dedicated young film enthusiasts. Rosa Allen reports.
Cambodia's film industry flourished for a heady decade and a half from the early 1960s. Around 350 movies were produced during the period, but few survived the destructive and murderous Khmer Rouge era. The stars of the B-grade, often fantasy-themed films were immensely popular across Southeast Asia, and much of the remaining memorabilia has ended up outside of Cambodia, as far as France and Hong Kong. 20-year-old Rin Chumvarak began the Priya Soria Group at the age of 17. Continuing the work of other Cambodian film buffs in France and the US, and through interviewing surviving actors and a lot of legwork, the university student has tracked down more than 40 films, many of them thought previously lost, on video cassette and film reel.
I created the Priya Soria Group in 2010 because I wanted to gather youth who love films, old films, and get back all the materials that were being lost.
Someone who understands just how precious the films and photographs of the era are is 69-year-old film actress Di Savet, still something of a celebrity in Cambodia. Before fleeing the country for France in the weeks before the fall of the capital in 1975, the actress and director ran her own film production company. Just 10 of her more than 100 films survive.
Cameras, reels and other equipment were all stored in my house. I have nothing with me. But some of my films were found to be in such and such a country, so I got copies from there. That's how they've survived.
This week, Chumvarak and his group will hand over some of its collection of video, 35mm film, posters and photographs to the Bopana Centre. Bopana film researcher Lim Saporn.
The oldest film that we have in Bopana Centre, 1899. This is the oldest film that Bopana have in centre. About the Go Dead and Swim, we have many documentary like News Letter. We have many film also, fiction film. Directed by Lodom Senu, by Lee Bun Jim and Di Savet.
In his search for lost film and its stars, Chumvarak has travelled to Bangkok and the provincial Cambodian city of Battambang. But from there, the movies found by the young film detectives might still remain unseen. The Bopana Centre doesn't have the resources to preserve the film, only to store it, says Lim Saporn. And it will join a list of film waiting for conservation work. This does not deter the Priya Soria Group, who hope to have their own office and archive in the future, says member Long D.
I wanted to find all of them, not just anyone in particular, because Khmer films at the time were getting better and better. The technicality of the films by 1975 was pretty advanced. One day, I want to keep them somewhere so that the next generation will be able to see them as well, just like the Bopana Centre.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care, we'll see you again in 7 days. Also, I want to remind you, you can tune to another edition of the program Sunday at 1330 UTC on our new frequency for Southeast and East Asia of 11990 kHz. Until next time, so long and take care.